36.
Last night, as we concluded, we were talking about the eighth chapter of the book of Revelation, the second angel sounding the second trumpet. And we had decided that that represented Genseric and the Vandals. And I think we had, for most practical purposes, finished talking about them. One of the notable things about them was that they took away from the city of Rome the golden vessels, and we talked about the golden vessels that had been in the temple in Jerusalem. It seems that the vessels of Jerusalem that Rome took and preserved, the Vandals took and perhaps destroyed. And as Kevin pointed out, a few months after the Roman invasion, Genseric was dead. So now I think we're ready for the third trumpet. And I'll read verses 10 and 11. This is Revelation 8, verses 10 and 11. The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. This third one, is probably as familiar as any of these that we're talking about in this set of four trumpets that are blowing. The Huns were a group of people that the Romans had probably never heard of until just a few years before this. Maybe until around 440 AD, the Romans had never heard of these people. We have a star in verse 10, and we're coming to be familiar with the fact that when a star is used, it refers to a prominent individual, and that was certainly true of Attila. Of all these people we're talking about so far in this list, he's probably by far the most famous. I think all of these groups that we've talked about under the seven trumpets sort of sound like rock bands, don't they? Alaric and the Goths, Genseric and the Vandals, Attila and the Huns. It could give a wrong impression to some of our contemporaries, but these were barbarian hordes of invading armies. Attila, it said there, fell from heaven as if he was on a course that was meteoric, shooting through the sky, and his name has become legendary. I might read a description of him since he is a prominent individual. From the Age of Faith, I read you an excerpt from the Age of Faith last night, just a paragraph or so. I'll read another paragraph from page 39. Page 39 in Will Durant's Volume 4 in the Story of Civilization, The Age of Faith, where he's quoting from Priscus, who visited Attila's camp one time and brought back this report about Attila. He was a man born into the world to shake the nations, the scourge of all lands, who in some way terrified all mankind by the rumors noised abroad concerning him. He was haughty in his walk, rolling his eyes hither and thither, so that the power of his proud spirit appeared in the movement of his body. He was indeed a lover of war, yet restrained in action, mighty in counsel, gracious to suppliants, and lenient to those who were once received under his protection. He was short of stature, with a broad chest and a large head. His eyes were small, his beard thin, and sprinkled with gray. He had a flat nose and a swarthy complexion, revealing his origin. Attila was a great warrior, as was said there in that passage. He absolutely loved war. And according to Gibbon, Attila considered himself the receiver of celestial favor. He thought that divinity was on his side, and he asserted his divine claim to the dominion of the earth. It was an interesting thing about 30-some years ago when the Ayatollah Khomeini was so prominent. Remember, he held some Americans hostage for 444 days, I think it was. One of the most famous men in the world for a while. Time magazine in 1979 recognized the Ayatollah Khomeini as its man of the year. And there was a great uproar about that. How can you make the man of year out of a villain and so forth? So that somebody, and I cut that out and stuck this in that in this book at the time, somebody in a spoof of that wrote an article about Attila the Hun as if he was Tempest Magazine's Man of the Year for the year 447 A.D. And it goes on to spoof. I'm not going to take the time to read it to you, but it's very interestingly done. He was one of the most famous men of his time. By 444 A.D., Attila was the most powerful man in Europe. And since I've been reading to you consistently from Edward Gibbon, I'll read you another section here. This from Volume 2, Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Modern Library Edition, Volume 2, page 243 and a little bit from 244. Just to kind of set the stage for Attila here. The Western world was oppressed by the Goths and Vandals, who fled before the Huns. Now that's the order that we have them on the board. But the achievements of the Huns themselves were not adequate to their power and prosperity. Their victorious hordes had spread from the Volga to the Danube, but the public force was exhausted. Now notice that this, the third trumpet is dealing with the rivers. The first trumpet dealt with the land, the second trumpet dealt with the sea, the third trumpet deals with the rivers, the third part of the rivers. The rivers in the third part, in this Western Roman Empire. So he's talking here about the Volga and the Danube. But the public force was exhausted by the discord of independent chieftains. Their valor was idly consumed in obscure and predatory excursions, and they often degraded their national dignity by condescending, for the hopes of spoil, to enlist under the banners of their fugitive enemies. In the reign of Attila, the Huns again became the terrors of the world. And I shall now describe the character and actions of that formidable barbarian who alternately insulted and invaded the East and the West and urged the rapid downfall of the Roman Empire. Attila was known as the Scourge of God and tried to live up to that kind of a name. We have the expression wormwood used down in verse 11. We find a reference to wormwood in the third chapter of Lamentations, verse 15 and 19. For the sake of time, I'll not turn back there and read it, but it's talking about wormwood as an emblem of sorrow and calamity by reason of the bitterness of its taste. That was the primary thing that wormwood was known for. It tasted very, very bitter. It was related to the sagebrush that we have a lot of out in the western part of our country. From sagebrush, you've got, or from wormwood, you've got the oil that's obtained from the dried leaves and the tops of it that sometimes is called absinthe. I don't know if you've heard of absinthe or not, but it's a green liquor, the continuous use of which results in mental deterioration or death. Absinthe is 68% alcohol, so it's a very, very strong drink, now banned in most Western countries. Edgar Allan Poe is famous for the drinking of absinthe. I don't know whether he really did or not, but he got blamed for that and died at the age of 40. It may not actually be true that he was a user of it, but he is renowned for that, and once these rumors get going, it's hard to stop them. Attila was one of the greatest barbarian rulers who assailed the Roman Empire, attacking various portions of it, as I read to you, east and west. But in 452, he invaded Italy. And since we're thinking about this Western Roman Empire and Rome in particular, that's what I wanted to focus on. He invaded Italy in 452. He sacked several cities along the many rivers of that area because it's very mountainous up there. Lots of, wherever you got mountains, you've got valleys between them and rivers running through them. So lots of rivers. And he was specializing in cutting off the headwaters in a very cunning and strategic way. So the emperor of the Western Roman Empire, centered at Rome, Valentinian III, he sent three envoys, as well as the bishop of Rome, whose name at that time was Leo I, sent him out to meet Attila while he was some distance away from Rome. And it is said that the deliverance of Italy that they were able to effect was purchased at an immense amount of money. So they bought off Attila, and he never even invaded Rome because he got so much money without even having to. And in a few months, following the same pattern we've been seeing in these trumpets, in a few months, Attila was dead. They say that his body was weighted down and was sunk into the Blue Danube River. And that fits with the fact that he was about the rivers, and this 10th verse especially cites the rivers, and the 11th verse talks about the waters. So that's the third trumpet. Anybody have anything to ask or say about that? Okay, let's go quickly on to the fourth one, because these are all of one piece. And I'm just going to go ahead and put this up here. Odoacer and the Heruli. AD. There's no question in my mind of what that's the fulfillment of this fourth one, even though it's short. The fourth angel sounded, verse 12, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. Now remember when we had a great revolutionary upheaval in the sixth chapter, we saw it was about the sun, moon, and stars. Same thing here. Prominent people. Big change taking place. And so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Odoacer and the Heruli, I think, has to be the answer to this. The sun, moon, and stars here has the same meaning that it did back in chapter 6. Kings and prominent people. And the main point about Odoacer is that Odoacer was the first barbarian king of Italy, 476 AD. And this is the date that we ordinarily give for the fall of the Roman Empire, so far as the western portion of it is concerned. Going back to Gibbon, Volume 2, for just a moment, I'd like to read a statement from page 344, just to get the flavor of this. Odoacer was the first barbarian who reigned in Italy over a people who had once asserted their just superiority over the rest of mankind. The disgrace of the Romans still excites our respectful compassion, and we fondly sympathize with the imaginary grief and indignation of their degenerate posterity. But the calamities of Rome had gradually subdued the proud consciousness of freedom and glory. In the age of Roman virtue, the provinces were subject to the arms and the citizens to the laws of the Republic, till those laws were subverted by civil discord. And both the city and the provinces became the servile property of a tyrant. The forms of the Constitution, which alleviated or disguised their abject slavery, were abolished by time and violence. The Italians alternately lamented the presence or the absence of the sovereigns whom they detested or despised, and the succession of 5 centuries inflicted various evils of military license, capricious despotism, and elaborate oppression. During the same period, the barbarians had emerged from obscurity and contempt, and the warriors of Germany and Scythia were introduced into the provinces as the servants, the allies, and at length the masters of the Romans whom they insulted or protected. Moving on just a little bit, a few pages to 436, just to cut across the lower 40 so that I don't bore you too much with this. But I wanted to read this portion on page 436. I have now accomplished the laborious narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, from the fortunate age of Trajan and the Antonines to its total extinction in the West. So Gibbon starts where the book of Revelation starts. This is why I've pointed out that it seems that his writing of this may have been providential and he was an involuntary servant of God. From the fortunate age of Trajan and the Antonines to its total extinction in the West about 5 centuries after the Christian era. At that unhappy period, the Saxons fiercely struggled with the natives for possession of Britain. Gaul and Spain were divided between the powerful monarchies of the Franks and Visigoths and the dependent kingdoms of the Suevi and the Burgundians. Africa was exposed to the cruel persecution of the Vandals and the savage insults of the Moors. Rome and Italy, as far as the banks of the Danube, were afflicted by an army of barbarian mercenaries whose lawless tyranny was succeeded by the reign of Theodoric the Ostrogoth.
all the subjects of the empire who by their use of the Latin language more particularly deserved the name and privileges of Romans were oppressed by the disgrace and calamities of foreign conquest, and the victorious nations of Germany established a new system of manners and government in the western countries of Europe. The majesty of Rome was faintly represented by the princes of Constantinople, the feeble and imaginary successors of Augustus. I think last night, in answering somebody's question, I mentioned that I had read that about the leaders of Constantinople being the meager and feeble successors of Augustus, but maybe I hadn't read it yet. Maybe I was just thinking ahead to that, which I had planned to read last night. Let me read you one more sentence, this from page 444. The splendid days of Augustus and Trajan were eclipsed by a cloud of ignorance, and the barbarians subverted the laws and palaces of Rome. So he's talking about going into what we often call the Dark Ages here. And that's the first four trumpets. They're all of one piece. They have these four men with these four groups, and it's four blows against the Western Roman Empire, and at the end of it, in 476, the Roman Empire in the West has fallen. And now we just have one more verse in chapter 8. And I beheld and heard an angel, says the 1769 King James. Probably that should be the word eagle. An eagle here, because an eagle is a bird of prey. It's the opposite of a dove of peace. Remember what Jesus said about the eagles in the 24th chapter of the book of Matthew? In Matthew 24, verse 28, Jesus said, "Wheresoever the carcass is, there shall the eagles be gathered together." I was coming along Route EE today when I saw a big old buzzard as I came around a curve, and it flew away, and I thought of this passage, "Where the carcass is, there shall the eagles be gathered together." And I think that's the reason perhaps that an eagle is used here. This eagle, bird of prey, is flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe! Woe! Woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." So we've had four trumpets, and now we have three more trumpets, which are described here as woes. The second group, the first group is four, and the second group is three. These are bound together by the word woe for each one of them. The fall of the Western Roman Empire was a third part of the empire. We've seen it depicted as being a third part of the earth, a third part of the sea, a third part of the river, a third part of the sun, moon, and stars. But it's all the same part of the empire, the west as opposed to the east and the south. The book of Revelation primarily is a book of comfort. All that God's people suffer at the hands of others is going to be repaid a thousandfold to those who inflict it. And the main message is that they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And there will be those who make war with him, but he will always be victorious. And as long as we stay with him, we'll be with it. Under Christ, victory is ours. Here's an interesting thing. Rome had always been known as the eternal city, but now it has fallen. And the fall really starts up here in 410 when they were sacked for the first time in 800 years. When Rome was sacked by the Goths in 410 AD, the Romans were just in a state of deep shock. They'd never even thought that this could be possible. You remember the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, where the enemy was taunting. The Jews were up on the walls of their city, and the enemy was taunting them from down below. And the Jews up on the walls of Jerusalem were saying, "This is God's city. You can't possibly destroy us, no matter what you do. God is going to providentially protect us." And then Jerusalem was just wiped from the face of the earth almost in 70 AD. It fell with the inhabitants sitting there doubting it. And the same thing was true here in the city of Rome. When it was sacked, the Romans were just in a state of deep shock. And many of them saw their downfall as a city as a punishment for abandoning paganism. And they started to think maybe they should go back to the old gods, some of them. Well, this was the time when Augustine, whom a lot of people call Saint Augustine wrote his book called The City of God. And the burden of the city of God was the same as the burden of the writer of the Hebrew letter in the New Testament. The writer of the Hebrew letter in the New Testament was predicting the destruction of Jerusalem and said, "Here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come." Augustine in the City of God was saying the same thing with regard to the fall of Rome. That was his basic message to these disillusioned Romans. Here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come. And he said that we should be concerned with the heavenly city. And that's right. That was the point of the Hebrew writer too. Woe, 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 at the end of verse 8. This bird of prey is proclaiming that the feast is not over yet. The city of Rome is fallen. A third of the empire is fallen. But after all, by this time, Rome wasn't even the capital of the Roman Empire anymore, after Constantine's time. So we've heard four trumpets, but there are still three woes yet to come. We'll find them in chapter 9, verse 1, in chapter 9, verse 13, and then in chapter 11, verse 15. Those will be the three woes. Questions or thoughts over the eighth chapter or anything preceding it? All right, let's go ahead and take a look at chapter 9. And I want to just read the first 12 verses here because they're all of one piece under the fifth trumpet. And I think it'll be easier to talk about it if we just have the whole thing freshly read and renewed under our belt. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. And unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, but shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their head were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. All right. As we approach the beginning of the ninth chapter of the book of Revelation, we are chronologically looking for something that occurs after 476 A.D. When this trumpet blows, we're looking successive to that date. And we see in verse 1 that there's another star here that falls from heaven, using the same method of interpretation for a star as a symbol that we've been using elsewhere, the same method the Lord gave us in chapter 1 when he said the seven stars in his right hand were the seven messengers of the churches. They were prominent personages. We saw that interpretation of the symbol held in chapter 6. We saw the same interpretation of the symbol of a star held in chapter 8, so we'll use that same method of interpreting the star here. This is a prominent person. A star fell from heaven unto the earth, and it seems impossible to me for this star in chapter 9 to be anybody other than Muhammad. So I'm going to put Muhammad's name up here under number 5. And it's not always spelled the same way. It can be A-D or E-D. It doesn't matter to me. We're looking for the sound. I'm going to go ahead and list a group of people known as the Saracens. Saracens just means Easterners, and Muhammad was in Arabia. When it says that he fell together as it appeared to man, that again could be a meteoric rise. It could also indicate the fact that he became a servant in the city where his ancestors had ruled. He was given a key to the bottomless pit. We've seen that a key is a symbol of authority. He was the ruler of Mecca. He had the key to the Kaaba in Mecca. I think you're aware in our time, because it's on the news a lot, of the Kaaba in Mecca. This is a sacred shrine. The Islamic people believe that the Kaaba in Mecca, and you've seen, you know what I'm talking about, that big black stone? It was originally constructed, according to Islamic belief, by Abraham and Ishmael, but in pre-Islamic times, it had become an idol shrine. Before the time of Muhammad, the Kaaba housed 360 idol statues. But in the times of Islam, it has become the most sacred site in Islam. Muhammad was given the key to the bottomless pit. This is the abyss, which is repeatedly referred to in the book of Revelation. Notably, it's referred to in chapter 20. And later on, when we get to verse 11, we see that the real ruler of all of this was Satan the devil. He was the one that was really behind all of this. In verse 2, there was smoke that arose out of the bottomless pit when Muhammad opened it. The smoke probably is indicative of the doctrine of Muhammad that came out of the bottomless pit. It didn't just come out of Muhammad, but he got it from the bottomless pit. We were told by the Apostle Paul at the beginning of 1 Timothy chapter 4 in verse 1 there that the Spirit speaketh expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. All false doctrines originate in hell. Every one of them. The demons down there are able, with a great deal of creativity, to orchestrate the thinking in order to facilitate the implanting of false doctrines. Just how they get them into the minds of people, I'm not certain, but it seems like they have the spiritual equivalent of radio waves or something like that, so that even when they are reserved in chains of darkness under the judgment of that great day and are no longer able to invade or possess people, they're still able to send out false doctrines and implant them in susceptible or willing minds, minds that are fertile for that type of a thing. Now, we all may have these types of things occur to us, but if your mind is not susceptible to that, if your mind is refreshed by the Word of God, if you have God's Word as a grid attached to your mind, then these false doctrines are not going to successfully come through that filter. It has to be a mind that is susceptible, and sometimes purposefully susceptible, to this smoke of the doctrines of hell. There was a statement made in the book of Job one time, in Job 38, verse 2. Who is this that darkeneth counsels by words without knowledge? The same idea of a smoke, darkening things, obscuring things, confusing the issue. Confusion, of which God is not the author, is not his way in religion. God wants us to have clarity on the things that we need to know about. But there's a great deal of confusion that comes out of the pit. Muhammad darkened the minds of millions against the Word of God. In Islam, there was no pretense to Christianity. Now, we talked last night briefly about an apostate church that made a great pretense of Christianity, and we'll see a lot more about that later on in the book of Revelation. But Islam didn't even make any pretense to that. The penalty for defecting from Islam to another religion, including Christianity, was death. If you had been a Muslim and you defected from that to something else, it was death without mercy. I gave you a little note about Constantine when we talked about him, and I've mentioned to you that there are four men on the hub wheel of history so far as our understanding of the book of Revelation is concerned. Muhammad is the second one. First Constantine and then Muhammad, so I should tell you a little about it. Muhammad was born in 570 AD in Mecca. The name Muhammad itself means highly praised. Muhammad's father died 2 months before he was born, and his mother died when he was six. He was raised by a grandfather until his grandfather died, and then he was raised by an uncle. And through all of this, sort of moving around from pillar to post, as we sometimes say, it seems that nobody ever bothered to teach Muhammad to read or write. He seems to have been entirely illiterate, and he was never known to write anything himself. But illiteracy did not prevent him from composing the most famous book in the Arabic tongue, and from acquiring an understanding of the management of men that is seldom seen. We know almost nothing about the youth of Muhammad. Fables about it fill many volumes. When we lack information long enough, we invent it, so we'll have an answer to the questions that are asked. Muhammad had some financial savvy, and he supervised trade caravans that went out through the desert. He married his employer. She was his first wife, and she was 15 years older than he was, and was a huge influence on Muhammad. She provided him not only with financial security, but also with a great deal of encouragement and a burgeoning confidence as he later sorted out his religious experiences. There was a sizable community of Jews in Arabia at that time. We're talking about the 6th and 7th centuries of the Christian era. And we can picture Muhammad as a young man out on these trade routes where they'd camp out at night around the campfire, sitting around these campfires and listening to the stories that were told by the Jews and others that were in these caravans. Unfortunately, both the Judaism and the Christianity of Muhammad's day, those that he were exposed to, were in a very corrupted form by the 6th and 7th centuries. And the trouble was, Muhammad could not read any source material for himself. If you have been given the ability to read through your education, no matter whether it was a public school teacher that taught you to read or somebody else, this is a great blessing for you. You can search out the Bible for yourself. You don't have to depend on what somebody else says about it. You can search out many other things. Reading is a great key. Somebody who will not read isn't in much better shape than somebody who cannot read. And Muhammad was not able to search out the origin of these stories that he was hearing and find them at their pure source. So he just took what he heard. And over the 22 or 23 years that he later dictated the 114 seras, or chapters, that we now know today as the Quran, Muhammad regurgitated a great deal of what he had heard around the campfires as he remembered it, or he changed it to fit whatever his current situation was. The Jews of Arabia in those days were more acquainted with the fables of the Talmud and other Jewish fables than they were with the Hebrew scriptures themselves. It's most likely that Muhammad never had any direct contact with the Bible, and even if he'd had one, he wouldn't have been able to read it. Many stories in the Quran, I don't know if anybody here has read the Quran or not, but it's kind of a very strange book. Many of the stories in the Quran give the impression that something is missing, that this would make more sense if you had some additional information, more details. Some of them are even to the point where they seem indecipherable. When you look at the Jewish legend that was behind that story, and you find the source of that story, then often there are additional details provided in the context and for the meaning of the story as found in the Quran. I think it's no surprise to anybody here tonight that much of the Quran contradicts the Bible, and at the same time it coincides with the Jewish legends that were current in Muhammad's day. It was a product of its time and a product of its author, the man who dictated it. Muhammad adopted his young cousin, whose name was Ali, and Ali, at a later point, described his adoptive father. When Muhammad was 45 years old, this is what Ali said of his cousin. Muhammad was of middle stature, neither tall nor short. His complexion was rosy white, his eyes black, his hair thick, brilliant, and beautiful fell to his shoulders. His profuse beard fell to his breast. There was such a sweetness in his visage that no one, once in his presence, could leave him. If I hungered, a single look at the prophet's face dispelled the hunger. Before him, all forgot their griefs and pains. That's what his young cousin, who was adopted by Muhammad, said about him. As Muhammad approached the age of 40, he became more and more absorbed with and even obsessed with religion. And on a particular night that is now known in Islam as the Night of Power, this was in 610 AD, Muhammad was alone in a cave 3 miles outside of Mecca. And this is when Muhammad had the pivotal experience of all Islamic history. Here's the way Muhammad described this experience. Quote, "While I was asleep with a cover of silk upon which was some writing, the angel Gabriel appeared to me and said, 'Read.' And I said, 'I do not read.' He pressed me with the coverlet so tightly that methought 'twas death. Then he said to me, 'Read.' And I read aloud, and he departed from me at last. And I awoke from my sleep, and it was as though these words were written on my heart. I went forth until, when I was midway on the mountain, I heard a voice from heaven saying, 'O Muhammad, thou art the messenger of Allah, and I am Gabriel.' I raised my head toward heaven to see, and lo, Gabriel in the form of a man with feet set evenly on the rim of the sky, saying, 'O Muhammad, thou art the messenger of Allah, and I am Gabriel.'" Now, this wasn't the only such experience that Muhammad purported to have. He had many similar experiences and visions and convulsions and swoonings. Some people think that maybe he was subject to epileptic seizures, but we really don't know very much about that. Conjecture enters in. He began to make converts very slowly. Muhammad's first convert was his wife. His second convert was his cousin Ali, whom he had adopted. His third convert was his servant. His fourth convert was a man by the name of Abu Bakr, who figured highly in the Islamic religion later on. And Abu Bakr brought 5 Meccan leaders to be converted by Muhammad. In 612 AD, Muhammad began publicly converting the Arabian people to his new religion. Long story short, eventually all of Arabia submitted to Muhammad's authority and to his new creed. Meanwhile, Muhammad protested against being taken for more than a fallible and mortal man. Muhammad claimed no power to predict the future, and he did not claim any power to perform miracles. Unlike Jesus, Muhammad could not point to hundreds of prophecies that were written about him prior to his birth. Jesus could do that, and he did do that. And Jesus also claimed to be deity. But offhand, I can't think of any prophecies about Muhammad himself that he would have been able to point to that were written before his birth, except for this ninth chapter of the book of Revelation, and I don't think he would have wanted to point to this because it wouldn't have been very complimentary to him. It's claimed that Jesus predicted the coming of Muhammad. This is what the Islamic people say, that Jesus himself predicted the coming of Muhammad in John 16, verse 13, when he talked about the coming of the Spirit of Truth. You know the passage very well. When he, the Spirit of Truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth. And they say that that was a prediction about Muhammad. Well, obviously, to think that our Lord was talking about Muhammad there as the Spirit of Truth is just lunacy. It's just wacko. I mean, it's so far from reality, it doesn't make any sense. The Qumran is a very interesting book. It repeatedly makes excuses for Muhammad's inability to provide miraculous signs to support his revelations. Ordinarily, through the history of the world, when God has given new revelation, he's given confirmatory miracles along with it so that we'd know that this new information was from God. We see this, we see the miracles in the Bible cluster up around great times of new revelation, as in the days of Moses and as in the days of Jesus. Most people, even in Bible times, lived and died without ever seeing a single miracle. But when God was giving new revelation, he issued signs and wonders and gifts of the Holy Spirit, confirmatory miracles according to his own will. Meanwhile, Muhammad later on was unable to provide these at all. This is a great glaring difference between Muhammad and Jesus. Jesus verified his teaching by his miracles, and he made a special point to point that out in his teaching, that if you don't believe me, believe the works, the things that I'm doing. You've got to believe that there's a power behind them. Where evidence does not exist, God does not expect people to believe. He wants us to accept on faith, but an informed faith that has some evidence behind it. So he's interested in faith, in faith that is built on facts, not faith that is contrary to the facts. Muhammad, at the height of his power, lived in cottages. He mended clothes and mended shoes. He kindled fires. He swept the floor. He milked the family goat out in the yard. He shopped for provisions in the marketplace. He ate with his fingers and licked them. He obeyed his own prohibition against wine. He put on none of the pomp of power, and he rejected any special mark of reverence. He is said to have never asked any service of a slave that he had the time and strength to do for himself. And despite all the booty and all the revenue that came to him, he spent little on his family, less on himself, and gave much to charity. They say that Muhammad's voice was almost hypnotically musical, that when he spoke, it was just almost like listening to a song and would kind of put people into a trance. His senses were painfully keen. I don't know if you've known anybody like that or not, but sometimes there are people who have an especially acute sense of hearing, or their other senses will be like that. So loud talk or bells or even strong smells Muhammad could hardly bear. He was just had great sensory equipment so far as perception was concerned. His friends loved him to the point of idolatry. His followers would trail along after him, and if he'd spit on the ground, they'd pick that up, thinking maybe it would cure somebody. They would take, if his hair got cut, they would take that hair that had come off of his head. They would even collect the water that he used to wash his hands, expecting magical cures from all of these things. In 632 AD, Muhammad died at the age of 62. If we judge greatness by influence, then he is one of the giants of history. What did Muhammad accomplish? Well, when Muhammad began, Arabia was a desert that was filled with many, many idolatrous warring tribes. When Muhammad died, Arabia was a nation. It was united religiously, united politically, united economically. It was one in purpose, and it knew what it wanted to do. And though Muhammad himself seems to have never thought of power outside of Arabia, his successors were far different from that. Muhammad changed the map of Arabia, and Muhammad's followers changed the map of the world. So let's look a little bit at some of these things that are said in these 12 verses that we have read. We've already talked, I think, about the first couple of verses. We have locust in verse 3. Locust in symbolic language seems to refer to a numerous and destroying army. And we have Old Testament precedent for this. Back in Judges chapter 6, verse 5, the army of the Midianites came as grasshoppers for a multitude. When we read about grasshoppers or locusts in the Bible, it means that there's a lot of them. By themselves, individual grasshoppers and locusts don't accomplish much, but they do what they do by the virtue of the fact that there are so many of them. And you've seen, perhaps in your lifetime, grasshoppers come into a field and just eat it clean in a very short amount of time. The head of a grasshopper and the head of a horse really look quite similar to each other. So I think here we have a little thing symbolizing a big thing. Again, in Nahum 3:15, make thyself many as the locust. So we have that same kind of symbolism used there. And the locust is a particularly interesting and appropriate symbol here. The locust is particularly Arabic. It was an east wind, remember, at the time of the 10 plagues. It was an east wind that brought the locust into Egypt. So they would have been coming out of the area of Arabia. The locust would breed out there in those rainless deserts. The word Arab actually means arid. That's where it came from. They're the people who live in the arid places. Arabia is the largest of all peninsulas on earth. It snows out there once every 40 years, almost never. The nights, on the other hand, get down to 38 degrees. The sky is always clear. It's a perfect breeding ground for locusts. Now these Saracens that we've placed on the board there, Saracens or Easterners as they're called, they had an army that was unlike any other nation. It was all cavalry. In other words, it all rode horses. There was no infantry because infantry in the desert wouldn't work very well. How far could they walk? The followers of Muhammad rode horses and they absolutely hated idolatry. Meanwhile, Byzantium, which was the old name for Constantinople had brought in icons into the worship of God. And they not only brought them in, but they were trying to force these icons and statuary on the people. The people who had this apostate church in Constantinople decided that all people had to worship according to them, or they would have to pay a price. They were looking for uniformity. We talked about this a night or two ago with reference to Constantine as well. An interest in uniformity and unanimity, even if it was a forced thing. So those who chose Islam were not going to have this idolatry that was being forced upon that part of the world. Therefore, they went on the offensive and they defaced the idols. By defaced, I mean they literally took the faces off the idols. You've seen idols, perhaps, or seen pictures of idols that the rest of the idol's intact, but somebody has come along with a chisel and literally knocked the face off the idol. When I was with Tom and Ann in 1978 down around Ashdod and Ashkelon and other places as well, we saw idols that had been defaced by the Muslims who had come through that country. And many of these are still available to be seen. You can pull them up on your phone right now if you choose to. That's a nice thing about what some of you have. I don't have it, but I know you've got it right with you. And if it's charged up, you can see as many defaced images as you want to see. Well, in 632, after the death of the prophet, and yes, I call Muhammad a prophet, albeit a false prophet, but he was a prophet. After the death of the prophet, in the same year that he died, Abu Bakr and his army left Arabia, and we could say of them, as it was said of somebody else back in chapter 6, verse 2, he went forth conquering and to conquer. But there was something really interesting about this conquering that's different and in direct contrast to the Goths, for example, that we read about in chapter 8. And I'll just read you a note from Gibbon, this time Modern Library Edition, volume 3, and just a note from 145. This is really on verse 4. It was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree. I'll just read a little bit here from page 145 of volume 3 of Gibbon. Remember, said the successor of the prophet, that you were always in the presence of God on the verge of death in the assurance of judgment and the hope of paradise. He's talking to his army. Avoid injustice and oppression. Consult with your brethren and study to preserve the love and confidence of your troops. When you fight the battles of the Lord, acquit yourselves like men without turning your back. But let not your victory be stained with the blood of women or children. Now listen to this. Destroy no palm trees, nor burn any fields of corn. Cut down no fruit trees, nor do any mischief to cattle, only kill such as you will eat. When you make any covenant or article, stand to it and be as good as your word. As you go on, you will find some religious persons who live retired in monasteries and propose to themselves to serve God in that way. Let them alone. Neither kill them nor destroy their monasteries. I think that fits here with kill only those who have not the seal of God in their foreheads. If there's somebody who's just off to themselves, they're not a part of this juggernaut that has become this apostate church that's trying to impose itself on everyone, then this successor to the prophet said, at least in these early stages, that you can leave them alone. And he's careful to point out that they are not to devastate the land. They're not there to destroy, they're there to conquer. And that's a big difference. They didn't come to kill, they came to conquer. As a matter of fact, they left a lot intact. They left intact local custom, local government, local laws, local taxation, and to some extent even local worship. They did collect tribute. The Saracens did not come to kill, but to conquer. They killed those who opposed them in battle, of course, primarily those from the apostate church. And I think that's what it means in the end of verse 4, only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. These were the people who opposed them militarily. The apostate church bore the brunt of the Muslim persecution. The pride of the bishops of the apostate church was dragged down into the dust, and they were helpless to force their doctrines on other people. The only soldiers that the Saracens had were Muslims. Only a Muslim could defend Islam. Now in verse 5 we have this about the scorpions. The torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man at the end of verse 5. I've never been stung by a scorpion. I came pretty close to it one time out in Arizona, but it didn't quite get me. But I understand it really hurts to be stung by a scorpion, but it doesn't usually kill a person. And I think that's the idea here. They did not come primarily to kill, but they did create a great deal of pain. And there's another thing, too. The Saracens were particularly adept at fighting rearward over the tails of their horses. And if you were to view that battle, like if you viewed it from the side, it would seem that the torment that they were inflicting came from the tails of the horses as they were looking back, shooting the arrows or whatever they were doing over the tails of their horses. So I think that's the depiction that we have here. And really, it's a very adept symbolic picture. A little bit more history about the Saracens. They left Arabia in 632, as we have said. In 634, they took over Damascus. Now, Damascus is the only oldest city in the world that has a continuous existence since its origin. Remember, even back in the days of Abraham, there was Eliezer of Damascus, who was a servant of Abraham, clear back in the early part of the book of Genesis. So it's a really old city, but from 634 on, ever since that time up until now, Damascus has been Islamic. In 637, they took over the city of Jerusalem. Church houses were turned into mosques. In 638, they took over Egypt. In 675, they attempted to take Constantinople, and they were driven back from it. So they went down across northern Africa, swept across it, and in 711, they crossed over from North Africa. They crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, and they conquered Spain. In 716, they besieged Constantinople for the second time, but again were rebuffed by those behind the huge and massive walls of the city of Constantinople. That's important because later on we find out what happened to Constantinople. In 721, they crossed over into France. This is really the most extraordinary phenomenon in medieval history, what the Islamic forces did. No conquering force has a record that is any more amazing than this. Actually, if they had not been stopped in 732 AD, just 100 years after they left Arabia, if they hadn't been stopped in 732 by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in southern France, they might have just gone ahead and swept through all of Europe. But they had a tremendous impact, and they removed a lot of power from the apostate church. Basically, people had a choice between two major powers. You could either be taken over by Byzantium and be put to death if your faith was different from theirs, or you could be taken over by these Arabs, these Saracens. You could pay tribute to them, and you could have some freedom of worship. Now, if you were a non-Muslim, you'd be a second-class citizen, that's true, but you might at least be able to live. And actually, this was pervasive for a long, long time. It wasn't, for example, until shortly before Columbus sailed that Ferdinand and Isabella finally expelled the last of the Muslims from Spain, the ones that came in at this time and the generations that followed after them. In verse 7, we see crowns of gold that were their turbans shining in the sun. They wore turbans on their head. At least on occasion they did this. Turbans shining in the sun to protect their heads from the shining of the sun. Their faces are as the faces of men. Probably indicates that they wore long beards. This was the style among them. You heard in the reading from Ali a while ago, the boy that was adopted by Muhammad, that Muhammad's beard fell to his breast. And that was true of the other Muslim men as well, of the soldiers there. They had the faces of men. They have beards. The shaved male face, as we practice it in our time, is one of the lasting legacies of Alexander the Great, basically in the West. But the Easterners did not shave as a general rule. And these people did not shave. And in verse 8, he says, their hair is as the hair of women. You heard Ali say that Muhammad's hair was long, dark, and thick, and it fell down to his shoulders. So they wore their hair long. And the teeth of lions there probably indicates the cruelty of these people. They were mighty warriors. In verse 9, they're talking about coats of mail there with these breastplates, the sound of many horses running to battle. Verse 11, again, indicates that the real leader of all this was Satan the devil, the doctrines of demons that he sent out and found a reception in the mind of Muhammad. Now, I want to get to this 5 months in verse 5 and verse 10. A period of 5 months is mentioned. If there's 30 days on average in a month, then you'd have 150 days here. And we really ought to talk a moment about the so-called day-year theory. I know many of you are familiar with this, but some of you, or the majority of you, may possibly not be. It's a symbolic interpretation that springs right out of the Old Testament itself. There, for instance, in Numbers 14:34, when the 12 tribes went into the land that God had promised his people, they were in there for a period of 40 days, and then when they came back, 10 out of the 12 said, we can't possibly take this land. So as a penalty for their unbelief, the Lord said, since I gave you 40 days to spy out the land and you don't believe me, you're going to wander as a people for 40 years until your generation of unbelievers dies off, and maybe we'll do better with the next generation. So 40 days that they had in the land is translated into the 40 years that they had to wander in the wilderness. Even more to the point than that, perhaps, is found in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6, where Ezekiel, remember, had to lay on one side for so many days, and then he had to lay on his other side for so many days, and the Heavenly Father explicitly said to him, I have given you each day for a year. Each day that you laid on your side is going to represent a year, a prophetic year in prophecy. So again, we have a little thing symbolizing a big thing. Just as a little animal sometimes will represent a big empire, so a little piece of time represents a big piece of time. Explicitly here, one rotation of the earth on its axis that we call a day, representing a revolution of the earth around the sun that we call a year. And I believe, and this, I don't know how much time I do know how much time we got, because I believe that the day-year theory has proven to be more than just a theory. Some people still write about it and talk about it as if it's just a theory, it's one possibility. But actually, there's more than one way in the Bible to show that the day-year idea or principle is beyond just theory. The ninth chapter of Daniel by itself shows that the day-year principle must stand, because that's about the 70 weeks, or the 490 days, and it shows that must be a period of 490 years, or else it won't work out at all, because he tells where it starts, and the Daniel timetable, as we find it in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27, cannot possibly come up to the time of Christ, as he clearly says it must, but it can't possibly come to the time of Christ if it's just 70 literal weeks. It has to be not 490 days, but 490 years to come to the time of Christ. Therefore, just by that one fact, the day-year principle stands proven as fact. Therefore, 150 days here in Revelation 9 must refer to 150 years. And there are a couple of ways of dating that. I mentioned that in 612 AD, Muhammad began publicly proclaiming his new doctrine. 150 years later, in 762 AD, their capital was moved from Damascus to Baghdad. Baghdad. You know, I used to teach the book of Revelation and talk about Baghdad, and people would come afterward and say, well, I didn't know Baghdad was a real place. I read about it in the Arabian Nights, but I thought it was just a mythological city. Boy, people don't say that anymore. Everybody now knows where Baghdad is. They know what's happening there last night, today. I mean, it's just been in the news all the time for a while. So we know about Baghdad. This is the time when their capital was moved from Damascus to Baghdad, built on both sides of the Tigris River, and Baghdad was called the City of Peace. Gibbon said of this period of time that war was no longer the passion of the Saracens. They felt that they had come to a time of learning and culture. But it's also to begin with the death of Muhammad. It's possible to begin with the death of Muhammad in 632 AD when the Islamic armies left Arabia and began conquering other countries. And 150 years from 632 would bring us to 682 when the Caliph Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad was involved in friendly correspondence with the so-called Christian rulers, and there was a great blossoming of Islamic culture. If the name of Harun al-Rashid sounds familiar to you, it may be because you read about it in the Arabian Nights. There's a lot in there about him in that. And this was the time when Islamic society really reached the zenith, not only of its wealth, but also of its learning and its power. This was the time when the Arabian Nights is from, the 1001 Nights. And al-Rashid is a central character in that literary work, where he is portrayed as the epitome of the learned and just ruler who always makes the right decision. The Muslims, by the way, actually took the literary classics of antiquity that had been written in the classical languages and translated them out of the Greek and the Latin into Arabic and preserved them in the Arabic language. Later on during the Renaissance, when Europe finally came out of the Dark Ages and was interested in learning again, they had to dealing with works that had been lost during the Dark Ages, they had to go to the Arabic translations of the classics and translate them not only back into original languages, but into the vernacular languages of Europe. So Islamic culture played quite a part in helping the Renaissance to triumph. The point here is that Baghdad, as at the height of its culture, was considered the city of peace in the reign of al-Rashid. Yes, Tom, please.
You misspoke there.
Thank you.
You said from 632 to 682.
I'm sorry. 632 to 782. Thank you. 782. Thank you. Yeah, when I start trying to go fast, I always mess up. Mike?
I have to ask this question
Okay.
Since we're on this.
All right.
How do you correlate, you know, this Muhammad and the Saracens and this military power at this time ending then, and yet the religion of Islam today and the world power that it represents and all of the
right.
killing and the wars in the name of that?
Right. Right.
The ending is for these people, not for what Muhammad taught. In fact, the very next, the one that we're not going to cover here in chapter 9, but if we were to cover this sixth one, they're Muslims too. I'll just tell you, I believe it's the Turks. And they're just as Muslim as the Saracens are, but they're a different group of people. And they have another seal here. And they're the ones that actually go ahead and take over the city of Constantinople, and the eastern part of the empire falls. And when the eastern empire falls, at the fall of Constantinople on May the 29th, 1453, that's the end of Edward Gibbon's works, right there. So at the end of chapter 9, we're through with Gibbon. You don't have to listen to Gibbon anymore.
I guess what I was getting at too, though,
okay.
is you know, the religion of Muhammad.
Yes.
You know, someone could look at that and say, here we are in verse 12, one woe is past.
Right. And I think it's because of
say,
this
well,
was the Saracens.
Right.
Well, it's because that's the Saracens. The Turks were a completely different group of people that came from a different place, but they did embrace the Islamic religion. That's what they had in common. So this carries on down. And later on, even later in the book of Revelation, I think we find more about the Islamic religion. So this is not intended to state that the Islamic religion ended, and that's a good thing to point out. Appreciate that. Tom.
John is writing about things that are going to take place consecutively
right.
in that time frame that he's talking about.
Right.
Sure, Islam is a world danger now, but these were certain incidents that he's following during the Roman Empire.
Right. And different groups of people, a number of them espousing this same religion. Yes. Were there other questions? Yes, Kevin.
It's interesting to note that as the this was mainly where the Christian churches had been established.
Right.
I mean, Paul, I mean, are there any places where Paul had gone and the, that we have recorded in the Bible that did not come under the Islamic sway at that time?
Most of the places did. Yeah, I mentioned earlier in the week that Turkey today, with these letters to the seven churches were written to a portion of Turkey. Turkey today is 98% Muslim, under almost complete sway of the Muslim religion. And I'm sorry, we're past our time again. This would be a place to talk about the Islamic religion as it exists now. One out of every five people on earth tonight is follower of the religion of Islam. 1,300,000,000 people the last time I checked, and that's growing even as we speak. It's projected that by the year 2025 there will be 2 billion Muslims on the earth. It's the fastest growing of the major world religions, driven by high birth rates in Muslim countries, third world countries in the Muslim world. There are more than 7 million Muslims in the United States right now. It's the fastest growing religion in America, so that's closer to home. And there's a great tension between the Bible and the Quran, and we haven't heard the end of the Muslim situation, because there's an inexorable incompatibility that's permanent between the Bible and the Quran. And they're at loggerheads with one another. The Quran depicts Jesus as a mere prophet, but if Jesus is who the Bible claims he is, then the Quran is fictitious. And you can't go both ways on this. You can't say, well, I think they're both two honorable religions. You can't say that. You know, that we had a president a few years ago who, when the Pope died, he said that he was a great and holy man. But then he also said that Islam is a great and noble religion. Well, how can those both be? Those can't both be right, unless you're a politician, I guess. So if we're looking at reality, we've got to look the thing in the face and deal with it and come to considered convictions about what we're looking at. I'm sorry we have to stop right there, but I appreciate your kind attention all throughout this week, not just including tonight, but all the time that we've had to spend together. That's a little taste, at least, of the book of Revelation and what the Lord has placed in it for us. And